That's Lee Morgan on trumpet. He's a trumpeter and composer, leading his wonderful quintet here with The Sidewinder, the title track from the album of the same name, released in 1963, featuring Joe Henderson on tenor sax, Barry Harris on piano, Billy Higgins on drums, and Bob Crenshaw on bass. Lee Morgan died tragically at the age of 33 on February 19th, 1972, but by then he had accounted for himself as a prolific trumpeter and composer. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, January the 27th, the eve of President Obama's State of the Union Address, which airs nationally tomorrow at 9 p.m. Eastern. So, naturally, we're talking about it today. We're talking about it, and we're talking about him. Let's get to it. We begin with an analysis of the key points of last year's State of the Union Address, this one offered by the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C., dedicated to the principles of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Let's hear how they analyzed the 2013 State of the Union Address.
51 years ago, John F. Kennedy declared to this chamber that the Constitution makes us not rivals for power, but partners for progress.
President Obama clearly wants to continue the legacies of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. He wants to expand the American welfare state, and he wants to save the world through government. But I also heard in this speech echoes of President Clinton, the emphasis on the middle class, the praise of hard work. But President Clinton didn't focus on taxing just millionaires and billionaires. President Obama knows we live in an era of limits. We are living toward the end of the American welfare state, and our president knows it.
Over the last few years, both parties have worked together to reduce the deficit by more than $2.5 trillion, mostly through spending cuts.
Let's be absolutely clear. There have been no spending cuts under this president. In 2010, the first year that this president was responsible for the budget, the federal government spent $3.4 trillion. Last year, the federal government spent $3.5 trillion. And for the first 4 months of this year, we're spending at a faster pace than we did in the first 4 months of last year.
These sudden, harsh, arbitrary cuts would jeopardize our military readiness. They devastate priorities like education.
First of all, the federal government only provides 10% of total education funding. You're talking about a 5% cut to that. That becomes a 0.5% cut to education spending. Then you put that in total context, huge increases in spending at all levels of government on education and flatline achievement, you realize that this isn't a devastating cut, it's way too small a cut.
The biggest driver of our long-term debt is the rising cost of health care for an aging population.
What's driving our long-term debt is government spending on health care. Politicians don't know how to run a health insurance plan like Medicare, so all they do is throw more and more of our money at the problem.
Already, the Affordable Care Act is helping to slow the growth of health care costs.
It is true that health care costs have risen more slowly over the last couple of years, but most health care economists say that's because of the recession. If people have less money, they spend less money on health care, and that brings down the cost. But the government's own actuaries suggest that in the future, health care costs are going to rise more quickly, and in fact, more quickly as a result of the Affordable Care Act than they would have if the law had never passed in the first place.
We'll reduce taxpayer subsidies to prescription drug companies and ask more from the wealthiest seniors.
No one has done more to increase taxpayer subsidies to drug companies than Barack Obama has. But to his credit, if he wants to reduce Medicare subsidies to the wealthiest seniors, more power to him.
And I am open to additional reforms from both parties, so long as they don't violate the guarantee of a secure retirement.
He wants to provide seniors with a secure retirement and yet generate massive additional savings from our entitlement systems. You cannot pay doctors less and not expect to hurt service quality. You cannot pay drug companies less and not expect to get less drugs. I think all of his other spending plans are therefore just not credible.
Today, our scientists are mapping the human brain to unlock the answers to Alzheimer's. They're developing drugs to regenerate damaged organs, devising new materials to make batteries 10 times more powerful.
Well, this is really a reference to electric cars, which have never sold in the volume that President Obama said that they would. The American people have consistently rejected the electric car, and now even the New York Times and the Washington Post are calling for the end of the electric car scam.
And tonight I'm announcing that we will launch talks on a comprehensive transatlantic trade and investment partnership with the European Union.
Trade talks between the United States and the European Union are a big deal and potentially very good news for free trade. The United States and the European Union are the two largest economies in the world by size, and the amount of trade between them constitutes almost one-third of world trade flows. But these trade talks tend to linger on. Trade talks within the Pacific region are now in their 16th round of negotiations, and there's no end in sight.
Right now, countries like Germany focus on graduating their high school students with the equivalent of a technical degree from one of our community colleges.
President Obama is right that other countries have a lot more educational options than we do, more robust vocational tracks, lots of different ways for kids to get educated. And that's what we need. The problem is that President Obama opposes the best way to get those sort of options, and that's school choice.
Through tax credits, grants, and better loans, we've made college more affordable for millions of students and families over the last few years.
We make it more affordable by giving you more money to pay. But the reality is that what that money does is just lets colleges raise their prices with impunity. That's why you see greater inflation in college than any other sector of the economy, including healthcare.
The time has come to pass comprehensive immigration reform.
President Obama's vision for immigration reform did not include an essential component, the creation of a large and robust guest worker visa program for lower-skilled workers. Such a program is absolutely essential in order to channel future immigrants into the legal market and provide the legal workforce that America needs to continue to grow.
Women should earn a living equal to their efforts. And finally pass the Paycheck Fairness Act this year.
For 50 years, it's been illegal to discriminate based on gender in hiring, promotion, and salary decisions. This isn't about that. This is a bonanza for trial lawyers and bureaucrats to insert the government at all levels of employment regulation such that the employer has to prove that any difference in salary isn't discrimination, regardless of qualifications, choices, or anything else.
Corporate profits have skyrocketed to all-time highs, but for more than a decade, wages and incomes have barely budged.
Part of the reason wages aren't rising faster is that Obamacare is eating into workers' wages by increasing the cost of health benefits.
Raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour.
If your productivity does not justify that wage, then you simply will not have a job. You cannot legislate wealth in this country. If you want to raise the wage to $9 an hour, why not $19 or $39 or $100 an hour? That does not produce wealth. That produces unemployment.
And we'll work to strengthen families by removing the financial deterrence to marriage for low-income couples.
Obamacare contains a marriage penalty, where couples are better off financially if they don't get married. So a great way to eliminate marriage penalties would be to repeal Obamacare.
Police chiefs are asking our help to get weapons of war and massive ammunition magazines off our streets.
The president is arguing against straw men. Machine guns have been illegal since the 30s. Weapons of war are not legal.
Most gun violence is committed with handguns, and much of that is connected with the war on drugs. If the president is serious about curtailing gun violence in this country, he should end a failed war on drugs and not commence an attack on popular firearms that are used for sport, hunting, and lawful self-defense, such as the AR-15.
None of the gun control measures that he's proposing, even the constitutional ones, have been shown to reduce gun violence in any way. Chicago and D.C. have some of the highest rates of gun violence, and they also have the most strict gun control measures.
I signed a new executive order that will strengthen our cyber defenses by increasing information sharing and developing standards to protect our national security, our jobs, and our privacy.
Think of the president's executive order as top-down, Soviet-style cybersecurity. It seeks to use the power of the executive branch to force the corporate sector to do the government's bidding without any authority under law.
Today, the organization that attacked us on 9/11 is a shadow of its former self.
So the president is right that Al-Qaeda is a shadow of its former self, replaced largely by groups that have proven again and again their inability to effectively strike at the American homeland. So it's ironic that what the president didn't mention is that the NSA continues to sweep in an unimaginable quantity of internet and telephone communications using the extraordinary powers granted them by the FISA Amendments Act of 2008. The FBI continues to build a network of informants far beyond the dreams of J. Edgar Hoover, even as the domestic threat now largely consists of unemployed losers that the FBI has to provide with funding, bombs, and even plans.
Tonight, I can announce that over the next year, another 34,000 American troops will come home from Afghanistan. This drawdown will continue, and by the end of next year, our war in Afghanistan will be over.
It's welcome news that President Obama said he's going to cut U.S. troop numbers at least in half by next year. What he didn't articulate is exactly how many U.S. troops will remain after 2014 and what their designated role will be.
America's commitment to a unified and sovereign Afghanistan will endure.
President Obama really shifted the goalposts on Afghanistan. The original objective of the surge was to reverse the Taliban's momentum. When that failed, which it did, what he ended up doing is retroactively reshaping what the goal was supposed to be, which is expanding the number of Afghan security forces. And certainly they've increased in terms of quantity, but not in terms of quality. We've seen increased number of defections. We've seen a rise in the number of insider attacks against U.S. and coalition forces. And also we've seen them also making de facto arrangements with the Taliban, with the enemy that we've been fighting over the past 12 years. Unfortunately, we cannot resolve Afghanistan's internal conflicts and internal politics, and really we can't resolve also the proxy battleground that Afghanistan has become.
We don't need to send tens of thousands of our sons and daughters abroad or occupy other nations. Instead, we'll need to help countries like Yemen, Libya, and Somalia provide for their own security.
If we're going into Yemen and Libya and Somalia and Mali, why not Pakistan? Why not Haiti? Why not Botswana? Why not dozens of other countries around the world? What he did not articulate is a limiting principle in terms of where we should and should not intervene.
And not a single word about neighboring Mexico. And the over 60,000 people who have died there in the last 6 years in a U.S.-sponsored war on drugs.
So in the months ahead, I will continue to engage Congress to ensure not only that our targeting, detention, and prosecution of terrorists remains consistent with our laws and system of checks and balances, but that our efforts are even more transparent to the American people and to the world.
President Obama has embraced and expanded the legal justifications and the conceptual framework of President Bush's war on terror policies. Not only has he increased the number of drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, he's also claimed the authority to detain American citizens indefinitely and to draw up secret lists to kill Americans without charges.
It takes extraordinary chutzpah to speak the language of transparency when it comes to drone strikes, when only after the leaking of an extraordinary Justice Department white paper did the president finally condescend to provide even Congress with the basic legal justification for a program he uses to unaccountably and unreviewably determine which American citizens abroad are to be killed without trial.
Transparency is not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is political leaders with unchecked power.
Thank you. God bless you. And God bless these United States of America.
Well, that was an analysis by the Cato Institute of President Obama's 2013 State of the Union Address. You may or may not agree with some of their views, but it is interesting to have a kind of buffer in between that State of the Union Address and what I'm about to say, because I have a different view also about President Obama and the impending State of the Union Address. And it has less to do with the address itself and more to do with the president himself. Well, of course, he arrives at this moment, the first year of his second term, with a huge number of political deficits. And chief among them is his credibility and, in fact, his growing liability even to the Democratic Party. This is what is happening. When President Obama was elected in 2008, there was all of this incredible hope invested in him. He was seen as a fantastic answer to long overdue attention needed by the constituencies that were suffering more than any others in the United States. And they demonstrated that by voting for him in numbers that were earth-shattering. Politically, there had not been that kind of a response to a presidential candidate. And he comes along. And, of course, we understand it as packaging. He was a very handsome guy, very personable, young, youthful. He had great ideas, fresh ideas, certainly. Even if they were not great, they were certainly fresh. And people wanted fresh. They wanted fresh ideas. And so he spoke a language that these distinct constituencies had been waiting to hear for a long time. Now, on the cynical side, people could say, well, this was orchestrated. And the answer is yes. That's what has to be done. You have to orchestrate the sale. You have to make people get you, get what you're about. And it is all about fashioning a figure so that people instantly pick up certain things about you that you don't have to spend a lot of time discussing. They could get from just looking at the way you handle yourself and the you're coached into how to speak, so you speak in news bites and you do all the right things and you energize the public. And the public was energized. In fact, it was a watershed in political history. Not only the response of the community, but the appeal of the candidate, and more so, the science of selling the candidate. This was extremely important. It actually elevated the science of political science. These folks employed technology like nobody else ever had. They were very, very astute about how you create a groundswell of support. They had tons of money because there were so many people who were taken by his electrifying persona. And so the coffers were fully loaded, lots and lots of cash to do lots and lots of things. So we found that the response to him was extremely enthusiastic. Well, in 2012, there are specific indicators that something had begun to go wrong. This love affair was beginning to sour. The white vote went down by 12 percentage points, by 20 percentage points in 2008. He lost 12 percentage points of the white vote. And by 2012, he had lost 20 percentage points among whites. That's more than 7 million votes. Among younger voters, he had won 60% of the vote among those younger than 30. And in 2012, excuse me, that also went down. Something was wrong. The youth vote began to turn off. Among Latinos, we find that from 2008, he did gain some votes in the Latino community. From 68% of the vote, of that vote in 2008, it increased to 71% in 2012, an addition of about 700,000 votes, and largely driven by the appeal to this particular constituency on reform, immigration reform. And the gay vote, although only about 5% of total votes, 77% voted for Obama in 2012, and that was an increase from 70% in 2008, largely because Obama made it clear that he had a change of heart. In 2008, he said he believed marriage was to be between a man and a woman, and he changed that tune in 2012 and was rewarded with the support of the gay community. But the one community that still outpaced all others in terms of support was the African American community. African Americans walked through the fire with Barack Obama. And of these constituencies, these are the four main constituencies I'm identifying as being very crucial here now. Of these four, only the African American community didn't have an agenda that he thinks is important. Everybody else had a list of priority items, and he responded well to those. The African-American community that outperformed every other ethnic group, both in terms of the volume of votes produced and the numbers produced, record numbers, and the percentage of the vote that went to Obama, record numbers. But there was no synergy there. It was one of those take it for granted kind of votes. I'm going to do the right thing by you. So over the past 4 years, this president has spent a lot of time pleasing the constituencies he thinks that matter, and ignoring the constituency he thinks does not quite matter much. And even though he was buffeted all over the place, he got badly bruised by, I contend, his own way of governing. Some of it, of course, we cannot discount race and racism, racist attitudes. We can't discount that. That is an integral part of opposition to Barack Obama, white opposition to Barack Obama. Certainly it is part of the resentment initially that this newcomer who would rise meteorically through the ranks, who was in the Senate for just a blink of an eye, next thing you know, they have to call him Mr. President. That just didn't sit well with a bunch of the old guard who see him still as a person who has not truly merited his position. He hasn't truly earned it. He got it by being wily. All these different things that they're saying, it's largely because they resent the fact that an African American is in the White House, plain and simple. But we can't say that that's the only reason that Barack Obama has faltered in the last 4 years. A lot of it has to do with the fact that his candidacy and his presidency attracted a bunch of opportunists. And it appeared that he had sufficiently cut himself off from others so that he felt compelled to live with the vultures that surrounded him. His advisors had a plan. We will work for his election, not because we are convinced in some existential way that this particular president will make a huge difference in America. No, it was a clear calculation. We are throwing our lot in with him because, A, we control all aspects of this candidacy. We control it. And, B, we will make this candidacy work for us. That's been, it's so clear to me that that's been the attitude generally within Obama's administration. The people who he brought on in his cabinet and the people he associated with or were thought he was forced to associate with, these weren't people who were there to help his ascendancy because there was an opportunity, a golden opportunity to actually change some fundamental wrongs in society, to correct them. They saw that this was a great formula. You get the guy, people are reacting to him, he could sell them anything and they'll buy it. And we control. We are the people controlling what he does, what he says, where he goes, who he talks to. And we can control him to such a degree that we will achieve our own individual priorities first and then, you know, leave him to figure out what's next. All these folks, these Clintonites, the Clinton holdovers that were just plentiful within his ranks, they all got wonderful assists into higher office or into more lucrative positions or into greater responsibility and to whatever it is they wanted. Look at Hillary Clinton herself. Here's a person who clearly should have had a very, very much greater challenges, let me put it that way, in order to qualify for Secretary of State. But that was clearly a gift. That was the deal. You are going to make me Secretary of State, not whether she's qualified or not. And we know that from this last scathing report about Benghazi, which she will have to deal with if she runs, the State Department was utter chaos. She absolutely failed to run that department efficiently. And it was connected to all these horrible adventures and misadventures all around the world. But she got that. That was her gift. It wasn't that Hillary Clinton had any great identification with what Barack Obama saw as his primary objectives. You get the sense that this cabinet was a collection of entrepreneurs. Everybody has their own little thing that they want to get accomplished, and that is the number one priority. He didn't have the technical backup to deal with a truculent Congress. The same kind of savvy that his people had to launch his political career and to bring him to victory, that intense technology and intense effort was not there to maintain his success in his first term. Basically, the man was sitting there with a bunch of people who surrounded him who didn't particularly care for him. I mean, that's the bottom line. He can't say it, but we see it. He can't confess that he was in bed with a whole bunch of strangers, and they all have their switchblades out, and they all are very narrow in their focus, and they're greedy, and they hurry to get things done because they are operating on an entirely different timeline with an entirely different focus. They have entirely different priorities. Rahm Emanuel cut out early. He said, I'm done. I'll get you there. I'll be there with you. But, you know, I have my own presidential ambitions. So he's off to getting himself elected on the strength of the back vote that was generated for Obama. Obama, in effect, they use these black votes, and they strategically used Obama's appeal in these large urban centers, absolutely, to transfer it to themselves, although they didn't deserve it, didn't qualify for it. But that's how they organized his campaign. He really was, in many ways, a kind of straw candidate. We will create the man that we see is the persona that is needed so that we can get our objectives met and fulfilled. So when you look at Obama's cabinet, you saw a whole bunch of folks of two different types. One who had clear ideas about what they individually wanted to accomplish. And then you had the others who probably came on with very good motives in mind, but saw that this cabinet is in disarray. There is no cohesion here. How could you, as a head of state, have people who actually don't like you in your cabinet and are working against you in your cabinet? But he was not powerful enough, and or he was controlled to the extent that he could not change things. The other issue is, and this is where Obama's personal mentality basically came back to bite him, and that was that these folks who were now, I mean, they're relatively young men and women, and they had done an extraordinary thing with this particular candidacy. And so their attitude was that they're special, that they're smarter than everybody. And the president operates to this day with that same attitude. I am smart. I'm much smarter than anybody else. So what does he do? He just operates in a bunker. He does not engage Congress the way, say, Lyndon Johnson did. He doesn't have good working relationships. You could see that. He's uncomfortable about actually going to the seat of power, which is Congress, and engaging people in a mutual effort. He's lost currency there. He says, look, I am going to get my way. He again repeated the same thing just recently when he said, I have a pen and I have a phone. And therefore, that means I know how to get my way. And if I have to do it by executive order, that is by the pen, and if I have to do it by phones to get people to do what I need them to do, that's what I will do. But I have my way, and I know how to win. You're not smarter than me. The president is so vulnerable, and he knows it, because as smart as he is, as capable as he and his staff appear to think of themselves as being, these old guys down there in Congress, they've been there since chickens had teeth. And they successfully penned him in. They made him a lame duck. He can't get much done, and he knows it. Which is why that smorgasbord of things that he was going to do that was iterated in the tape that we heard, all these things that he was going to do, you won't hear that tomorrow night. He's a chastened man who has come to realize that he can't win with the formula that he has. He has no support in his cabinet, the kind of support that is needed. He doesn't even communicate. The cabinet doesn't even communicate that is actually working for the president. Hillary Clinton never acted like she was working, that the president was her boss. You remember that embarrassing interview where she had him sitting next to her as a prop and saying, well, he's my buddy. This was on her, as she called it, her exit tour. John Kerry doesn't act like the president is his boss. He acts like the president. You know, they have an agenda separate from Barack Obama's. And Barack Obama has so isolated himself from his own constituency. He hasn't done much that we think is important. For example, where's the employment plan? Where's the employment plan? Where's the aid to all these cities? But employment, just let's deal with just employment. Where is the plan? This is year number 5. It took 790 days before he met with the representatives of these distressed communities, which tells you the level of importance that he places on the leadership, such as it is. So he is suffering from his own self-inflicted wound and cannot, in the next year or going all the way up to 2016, his own party has informed him that his primary job right now is just raise the money. You go out there and raise the money. Forget all these plans. You know you can't get them done. And in some cases, the Democrats are very clear. Don't even come to campaign for me. You are a liability to me. I do not need a president saddled with NSA issues, saddled with drone issues, saddled with the catastrophe of Obamacare, saddled with all these problems. I don't need you. Please don't show up in my district. Things are tenuous as it is. If you come to campaign for me, I surely will lose. Even in his own party, you see evidence of this. People who are staying away from him. The president can't blame very much on the Republicans, but that's what they would do. They are the opposition. And the main task of the opposition is to hem you in, and they have done that. As smart as he is, as smart as his operatives are, these old guys down there have successfully penned him in. And so he will talk quite modestly tomorrow night. No big set of things that will be done and accomplished. He knows he can't do it. From now until 2016, his job is to ratchet down significantly any of his high-minded ideas. And that means for his constituencies, I'm talking now about those traditional constituencies, for the new constituencies he's already delivered. There are some ongoing feuds that will be settled within the U.S. Supreme Court and with legal challenges, but he has delivered. He has not delivered for African Americans, nor has he delivered for Latinos. Obama has a huge problem confronting him, and that is he can't move too significantly in any direction to get anything done. And that is a realization that his supporters should have. So they ought to understand that their job right now is to reconstruct their own political realities. Barack Obama is not going to be helpful. He too is concerned about his own welfare after 2016. He is the entrepreneurial president. How do I make as much money as Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton are making after the presidency? And everybody in Congress, in one way or the other, Congress now made up primarily of millionaires, they're concerned about themselves. What's happening to the people? Well, you know, they'll get to it eventually. But key to their interest is what will they be able to do for themselves? While they're there, what connections are they going to make? Just like Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, all that traveling. Nobody has really put together the staggering bill just in her travel alone. It's not that the travel was necessary to all these different far-flung places that she visited, but hey, she's got a plane available with the best pilots, with the best limousines, best safety and security, the best hotels, and the best meals. She doesn't have to shell out a penny. And do you really believe that Hillary Clinton made all those trips to all those different countries on U.S. business? You go ahead and believe that. The black vote is the vote, still the vote, that is absolutely neglected. And black voters ought to get their act together. The Democratic Party is fast outliving its usefulness. I contend it has already outlived its usefulness in many parts of the country. And we see that this president, a contrived president, a president now who is trying his best to figure things out on his own, perhaps with a little help, but not at all with the help that he probably had expected he would have. Not the expertise. They're doing their own thing. Geithner's over there at the Fed, and you have Jack Lew, who's gone, who used to be chief of staff. He's doing his own thing. All these people have moved on to greater things and are strategically located to help their individual contacts make tons and tons of money. And it is all predicated, it all started with the prediction that with this young man named Barack Hussein Obama coming along at this particular time and fashioned into the candidate that people would just die to support, that all of this was going in the end to serve their interests, not his and not the same people voting. So what will the president talk about tomorrow? Well, of course, he always talks about his great vision and all this kind of stuff. But the fact is, as I said, he's not going to accomplish very much. He is a lame duck. There's nothing new that would happen. There's no major task, the new task that he's going to take on. There's nothing that he will do that will cause there to be some controversy or huge argument that could adversely affect the party. This message he has already internalized, and that is why he has assigned himself in service of a Hillary Clinton's presidential bid in 2016, and as the titular head of the Democratic Party, helping it to raise record amounts of money, hoping that that would compensate, that would buy him some degree of cooperation from his own party. But it's clear the party's in big trouble. Not just the Republicans, the Democrats themselves are in disarray. Here is where the reality should seep in that people need to construct alternatives. Because if they succeeded at Barack Obama at that level, they can do it again and again and again. And your misfortunes will multiply year after year after year. So this is a time to construct alternatives, to grow your own leadership, to move away from this Democratic Party. It has very little to offer at this point to people who have clearly defined needs that are long unaddressed. And if they're not going to be addressed by a Barack Obama, chances are they're not going to be addressed by anybody else anytime soon. So don't have all that faith in what statements would be made tomorrow. This is politics. And in the end, we see Obama for what Obama is. Obama is meant to be a symbol. That's all. He's not meant to be a person who will actually create history in challenging and changing the fundamental beliefs and systems in the United States. He's not there to be an agent of change. He's just there to be an agent of facilitating other people's plans for their political futures and to deliver for their constituencies. We have to accept the fact that help, the kind of help that he needs to get things done, if in fact he were serious about really making up for lost time, he does not have that kind of help in his cabinet. He does not have that help in Congress. People in Congress are aware all 435 seats are up for re-election. These folks are very focused on being re-elected. That's it. For many, it's the best gig they ever had in their lives, the best salary they ever will earn, the best benefits they ever will enjoy, the best status that they ever would have. So they are seriously fixed on just being reelected. They don't have to be of service to their community. They just have to be reelected. Just last week, for example, when we talked about the situation, the catastrophe, yet another catastrophe occurring in Haiti. Remember earlier last year when we talked about the Haitian Family Reunification Program. Here is a congresswoman in Florida, in the middle of the largest population of Haitians outside of Haiti, who will not ask the president to just give the green light to a project already approved, which is to get people out of Haiti to their relatives here who want to take care of them until the situation stabilizes there. It's been already approved. But she will not do that. She will not do that because she's afraid. She's afraid that the Cuban community will be very upset. And she does not want, in any event, to be seen, even though she's African American. I don't want anybody to see me as a supporter of the Haitian community. So she remains inert. This is exactly the calculations going on all around the country. Don't have any faith that this group of legislators really want to change the fundamental realities in their suffering constituencies and districts. That's not what is happening here. So as you listen to President Obama tomorrow night, which I urge you to do, you will see that, number one, this smorgasbord of ideas and things that he will do certainly will not exist. He would probably mention the two or three and get that done. And he's going to talk about, of course, he's going to blame, whether directly or indirectly, Congress for impeding progress. And He can't even afford to go too hard in that direction either, considering that for the first time in all these years, they actually managed to work out a budget such as it is together. So he is a lame duck. And much of this is by his own volition. Can he change that? He doesn't have the courage. So the answer is no. He is still being managed and does not have the courage to act on his own. It's a sad fact, but that's the reality of it. So let tomorrow's State of the Union Address remind you that your job really is to see to your own political interests, if anything, to ratchet up your resolve that you will be ruthless and obsessive about your interests. You will ignore any of these labels that people come to you with, say, well, I'm a Democrat. You don't even want to know what that is because they don't know what it is. You judge them by their performance. And this president, sad to say, has failed. Again, I understand the race-based opposition to him, but that's not where the failure is. The failure is not in the race-based opposition to him. It is the race-based support of him that he absolutely rejects in service, he thinks, of approval by more desirable constituencies. Well, that brings us to the end of the program today. I talked a lot. I talked for the whole program. Tomorrow, of course, is open forum, so we will engage each other with this discussion again, if you so choose. But it is important to understand when you are being bamboozled. And we will have big bamboozling going on tomorrow. But remember, behind all of that is a realization by this president that finally he has to admit to himself he has been abandoned on the inside by people who should be helping him. He should have had that kind of help, expert help, the same kind of expert help that put him in office should have been right behind him getting things done, but they took off on their own quests for power and privilege. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call, and you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Thanks. Let's meet again tomorrow, open forum at 1 p.m. right here on prn.fm.